A recent poll shows President Trump's approval rating at 36%, matching his all-time low. 60% in that poll disapprove of his job performance in that survey, an all-time high. With numbers like that, you might think political candidates would keep their distance from Trump, but in 37 Republican primary elections this year, candidates with Trump's backing won 35 times. For the November midterms, Trump has thrown his support behind Leah Vukmir for U.S. Senate, Brian Steil in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, and Governor Walker. But will his endorsement help carry those candidates to victories? Mordecai Lee is a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. Mordecai, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Rob.
Well, it seems like there's two stories here, Mordecai: President Trump and Republican primaries, and President Trump and general elections. Let's start with those primaries. How would you describe the Trump effect when he picks from among Republican candidates?
Rob, you've zeroed in on it. Here we are in the first minute of the conversation, and that's exactly the point, that he's very influential with the Republican base. In other words, in primaries. The question is if his endorsements are influential in the general election. And that, based on Wisconsin history, I guess you'd say it all depends.
Well, we have some data to go on with the primaries, not so much for President Trump and the general elections. So let's set those generals aside. I mean, President Trump at 35 of 37, he's got a pretty strong winning streak. He's in some cases helped candidates come from, you know, not out of nowhere, but out of, you know, way back there somewhere and win in primaries.
It's incredibly impressive in terms of his political magnetism that, in other words, the base of the hardcore Republican voters have become Trump voters. They don't view themselves as part of a conservative establishment, but as sort of Trumpists. And so if he gives a signal, sometimes less than 24 hours before the primary, it's just an incredibly impressive performance how he influences the vote. He essentially is able to turn someone from a second-place finisher to a first-place finisher. And in politics, one rarely sees such powerful endorsement.
And that seems to have an effect even when the president doesn't pick a candidate. Looking at the race here in Wisconsin, the primary race for U.S. Senate, you had Leah Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson. They both definitely tried to portray themselves as a pro-Trump, a strong Trump supporter if they ended up in the U.S. Senate.
That's exactly it, Rob. In other words, they weren't letting any daylight come between them and Trump, no matter what they had said or done a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I mean, he's really conquered the party, and he's really shown the establishment of the party that if they criticize him at all, he'll endorse somebody else and that somebody else will win. In politics, politics is about winning elections, and Mr. Trump has just got a magic sauce.
I want to look at a recent race, the Republican primary for governor in Florida. He had a state agriculture commissioner, Adam Putnam. He had a lead. He was the establishment candidate. Then President Trump endorses Congressman Ron DeSantis. He's a congressman, not a nobody by any means. He surged after that, wound up winning handily in that race. Is that all Trump, basically?
I really think it is. We've got to consider sort of who the Trump voters are. In part, these are the regular Republican conservatives who have come to love him because he won an election for president that everybody thought he was going to lose. So he's a winner. They love him. They love how he thumbs his nose at the establishment. But he's also appealed to another layer of Republican voters that sometimes don't vote, and those are people with only high school education. Based on political science research, turnout, in other words, the propensity to vote, goes up with education. In other words, turnout goes down if you're only a high school graduate. But the Trump phenomenon has really transcended that generalization. And so we've got these unlikely voters turning out to vote.
Talking to Mordecai Lee from UW-Milwaukee about the Trump effect in November election. So let's turn now, Mordecai, to the big question mark here. President Trump going like gangbusters and helping Republican candidates win primaries. Based on polling, approval, disapproval, what we know about President Trump, what happens in November?
Gosh, if you and I had the answer to it, we could really make $1 million. Because I think there are a couple of variables going on that sort of cancel each other out. Generally speaking, in the off-year election, the non-presidential election, Republicans do better than Democrats. In fact, if you think about the governor's races, since 1986, when Tommy Thompson defeated Governor Tony Earle, there have been eight gubernatorial elections, and Democrats have won only two of them. Republicans have won six of them. That tells us that midterm elections skew Republican. Why? Well, they're not presidential elections. They're not as sexy. There's a layer of voters who only turn out to vote for that, the sexiest of all elections, the sort of Olympics of elections, which is the presidential election. So it skews Republicans, presumably because we're talking about people with above-average education, above-average income, or above-average age. But on the other hand, things have been changing. Younger people have been turning out to vote in presidential elections. There's the seeming blue wave that's occurring in Wisconsin. I think Wisconsin is a 50-50 state if we're making predictions about November. Gosh, for all we know, it's going to depend on some little old lady who lives off the grid up in northern Wisconsin, because everybody in Wisconsin has an opinion about Governor Walker and about President Trump.
Now, Vice President Mike Pence was in Milwaukee last week to campaign for Leah Vukmir in her challenge against Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. Pence was asked how often he and Trump would be visiting us here in Wisconsin in the weeks ahead. Here's a listen.
I promise you that President Trump and I will be here campaigning for Governor Walker and for Leah Vukmir every bit as much as they need us here, because these are two outstanding leaders.
The big question is for President Trump visiting in particular, how much does he excite Republican voters to vote for his candidates? How much does he excite Democratic voters to vote against them?
I think that's the crucial question. In other words, he would excite the Republican base. He would tell them to turn out. He'd tell them to hit the phones. He'd tell them to hit the doors. But at the same time, it would have a stimulating effect on people who don't like him. Generally speaking, the Republican conventional wisdom going into the fall elections is that it's better to have Trump than to not have him. But Governor Walker is such a fabulous politician, whether one likes him or not politically or ideologically, that Governor Walker is trying to get the benefit of a Trump endorsement or a Trump appearance at a rally, at the same time not turning off that layer of Republican voters who are really turned off by Trump. And the stereotype of those voters generally are women, generally college graduates, sometimes homemakers. They're generally conservative on values, generally conservative on tax and economics, but they're generally left of center on values. So who knows? Waukesha County might turn out to be, instead of the sort of winning field for Republicans, might be the battlefield for Republicans.
Right. Wisconsin was one of, at least in the primaries, was one of the last never Trump holdouts. A lot of establishment Republicans tried to rally for Ted Cruz in the state. They didn't really embrace Trump until after he'd won the nomination. Does that matter anymore?
Leah Vukmir had not been a big supporter of President Trump until he got the nomination, and yet she was able to persuade the voters that she is currently loyal to Trump, was after he got the nomination, and would be if she was elected to the Senate. That seems to be what the voters care about. If you look at the map of those primary results, the Nicholson-Vukmir primary, she did very well in sort of the heartland of Republican establishment, which is sort of Waukesha County and the sort of southeast Wisconsin. And he did well in sort of that arc of rural Wisconsin, outstate Wisconsin, that is very much more Trump country. So it's really an unknown if the Trump voters, who maybe only vote in presidential elections, will turn out in a gubernatorial election.
Looking at a state like Virginia, where Democrats had a big win in their state legislative elections, people there say, hey, the Democrats weren't talking about Donald Trump. They were talking about traffic and roads and things like that. I guess thinking people already know what they think about Donald Trump one way or the other. Does that have a lesson for Wisconsin Democrats in what they talk about, what their strategy is?
I think there's a lesson there, but I'm not sure what the lesson is. Yes, they tried to avoid talking about Trump, and yes, they did very well in the election. But it looks like the fall election is going to be more of a referendum on Trump than generally speaking has been. I've been following Wisconsin politics since I was an undergrad at Madison in the 1960s. And generally speaking, going into a gubernatorial election, everybody says it's going to be a referendum on whatever president or party controls the White House. And generally speaking, in the past, the results of the elections have not been a referendum on the president. But I'm starting to wonder if maybe this November in Wisconsin, it will be a referendum on the president, which is sort of good news for Republicans and bad news for Republicans.
We're talking about the Trump effect on midterm elections, just over 2 months away. Mordecai Lee is with us, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's influence on elections, both in Republican primaries so far and then looking ahead to November? Is he going to rally more Republicans to vote for his candidates or Democrats to vote against them? Are you more or less likely to vote for a candidate who has President Trump's backing? If you're a Republican voter, do you see the president as an asset or a liability in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our discussion about President Trump and the influence of his endorsement in the coming midterms. Mordecai Lee is our guest, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think President Trump will have a big effect on elections this fall? What is the word in your part of the state? What are you hearing from people who voted for President Trump, against him? How do they feel now about November's elections? If you're a Republican, do you want more President Trump in the state campaigning? If you're a Democrat, do you think it helps you to have more President Trump in the state too? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Willem is on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I live in that area that the national media and your guest call this wide swath of Wisconsin, which is Trump country. But I'd like to remind the professor that Donald Trump won by 21,000 votes in this state, the village that I live in. He didn't win in the village of Colfax. He barely won in the town of Colfax. I have many neighbors who are traditional Republicans who are frankly offended by the president's behavior, his lack of any kind of moral center. So I think to just write all the people in western Wisconsin off as Trump supporters is really missing the mark by a long shot.
Willem, thanks for that call. And Mordecai, we've seen big swings in rural parts of western Wisconsin. Some of the biggest swings from Obama votes to Trump votes, they could very well be, as Willem is suggesting, up in the air.
Well, I'm glad Willem called, because he's really reminded us that when we talk about elections and we pundit the future, we're engaging in very broad generalizations. And so his example is perfect. He lives in that sort of Trump arc of outstate Wisconsin, but he personally and in terms of people he knows and the township where he lives are not Trump supporters. So when we're making these generalizations, we're talking about sort of the majority, just the tip that changes the balance of an election. And certainly, he won Wisconsin just by a hair. But it's also true that Democratic candidates in presidential elections won Wisconsin by a hair. You can go back to George W. Bush running for re-election. They thought they could win Wisconsin, and they just barely lost it. So it's fair to say that Wisconsin truly is a 50-50 state.
Willem, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Mordecai, you talked about how you have this long view. You've been watching Wisconsin politics for a long time. I hate to say things are unprecedented, but do you have a lot to compare the phenomenon of Donald Trump to in that span of time?
I can't think of any politician who's been as impressive politically, whether you like him or not, but impressive politically in terms of endorsements as President Trump. The generalization about endorsements in Wisconsin politics is that endorsements aren't very important. They rarely tip an election. Whether we're talking about AFL-CIO on the left, whether we're talking about Republicans on the right being endorsed by a prominent person, endorsements just don't seem to carry. In fact, endorsements are something to talk about leading up to an election before you know the election results. But I think President Trump has really sort of broken the mold, really created a new precedent that he is very influential with people following his lead. And so, as we talked about at the top of the hour, Rob, he's been incredibly influential in primaries. He may or may not be in general elections.
Looking at the polls for what they're worth, the people who track polls, President Trump has been, 41% approval ratings on average in a lot of polls. We've seen a couple pretty substantial polls in the last week or so showing him down into the mid 30s. It's early. Who knows if that trend holds? Is there a point where Republicans running for office, running for Congress, running for governor say, this has hit a point, we're seeing maybe Republican support erode, as a couple of these polls suggested. Is there a point where Republicans say, maybe I need to keep them a little more at arm's length?
Well, if anybody can do it, it would be Scott Walker. He has a fabulous fingertip feel for politics and for the public mood and public opinion. And so we can watch his behavior over the next 6 or 7 weeks, and we'll be able to answer your question. We'll be able to see how close he wants to hug President Trump, or how sort of occasionally he wants Trump to help him. You know, President Trump and Scott Walker, in terms of politics, are similar in only one respect, I would say, and that's that they never have high approval ratings. In other words, they're never 55, 60, 65, 70. They're always sort of in the mid-40s, and yet Scott Walker has shown that even though he's a figure with not a majority of approval rating or favorable ratings, that he's able to win elections. And so in that respect, there's a similarity here, that the Trump supporters are not going to walk away from him.
Talking to Mordecai Lee from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the potential impact of President Donald Trump on elections here in Wisconsin and around the country. And Mordecai, let's look a little bit at the race for control of Congress, the House in particular. Democratic or generic ballots showing preferences for Democrats. They need a pretty big win overall to retake the House. What are you watching for there?
Well, I think we should watch in Wisconsin, because these generalizations about Congress aren't particularly helpful, as Willem reminded us. But if we look at the seat that Paul Ryan is giving up, it's a relatively Republican seat. But now the question is it in play because of President Trump and because of the blue wave? Similarly, is Glenn Grossman's district, which is quite a Republican district, is it now in play because of these external circumstances? I'm reluctant to predict that this is going to be an unprecedented election, but I can say that it sure feels unprecedented. Now, the likeliest scenario is that Republican-leaning congressional districts in Wisconsin will continue to be Republican-leaning. But these two districts that I'm mentioning, gosh, who knows?
Right. People have pointed towards swings in special elections where even if the Republican won, they won by a lot less than historically Republicans in that district had won. You know, swings of 10-15% in a lot of cases. If that happens here in Wisconsin, does that mean a typically safe seat is not safe anymore?
Rob, I'm really glad that you're focusing on the record of special elections. You know, earlier when we talked about what are the factors that indicate a propensity to vote, some of the things I mentioned were education and income. So in a special election, that propensity to vote really controls. In other words, who votes in the middle of, you know, fill in the blank, in the middle of May? Well, it's people with higher than average education, higher than average age and income. And so the turnout in a special election might skew Democratic because of the issue of education and income. But I'm not sure that it'll be quite as influential when we come to a general election in November.
So looking at possible outcomes, one thing that could happen is we end up with split control of Congress. The Democrats take the House, say, but they've got a tough map in the Senate. What do you look for from a divided government then?
Well, presumably divided government gives us exactly what James Madison, after all, we named our state capital after him, what James Madison sort of wanted from the federal government. They wanted something stronger than the Confederation, which preceded the Constitution. They wanted a government that could work. But on the other hand, they didn't want a government that would be subject to the whims of public opinion. They wanted a government that would check and balance each branch. So I suspect that what we're going to be seeing, if there's divided government, we're either going to see just a dysfunction, a shutdown of the government, when happens sometimes when President Obama is a Democrat and there was a Republican Senate and Congress, or we're finally going to see a kind of a natural political dynamic towards compromise. Half a loaf is better than none. I would love to see that mentality return both to Wisconsin politics and federal politics.
One of the biggest things here in Wisconsin we haven't talked about yet is the race for the state legislature. The Senate may be in play. The Assembly maybe would be tougher odds for Democrats. How do these elections play out? Because no offense, I know you're a state legislator. People aren't necessarily really researching and digging into the candidate who's running for that race when there's big items like governor and Senate on the ballot.
Right. In other words, it's the degree of sexiness. Or sometimes when we talk about movies, we talk about a marquee name or a marquee race. You're absolutely right, Rob, that the Senate race in Wisconsin and the gubernatorial race is going to draw voters. But when you're dealing with, let's say, a state assembly race, it's 1% of Wisconsin population. Then you've got things like a friends and neighbors effect. Oh, I know so-and-so. I went to high school with so-and-so, and they said this person is a good person, is a good candidate. That starts being influential. So it's true that the number of people voting decreases as you go down the ballot. But these sort of peculiar local circumstances become stronger and stronger.
Now, Mordecai, I know you try to be cautious in your predictions, but every now and then you hit us with a bold, out-there prediction, sometimes a little cryptic. Do you have anything that's just really bubbling under the surface there that you're watching for that we should be watching for, too?
Okay, I'll make a prediction. It's nonpartisan. I'm going to predict that just like we had the turnout in the primary in August, which was really just above average, it was just an incredible flood of voters. I'm going to predict that the November election has a huge turnout, much higher than average, almost starting to look like a presidential race. And if that is true, then that means that the mix of voters totally changes.
All right. We'll watch for that over-under. Mordecai, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Mordecai Lee, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. We talked with him about the Trump effect heading into the November midterms in Wisconsin and around the country. Confirmation hearings are underway for Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh. The process is expected to last 3 to 4 days, with a vote coming sometime after that. By and large, Senate Republicans have been supportive of Kavanaugh since his nomination earlier this year. Democrats say the process is being rushed and are pushing back on the Trump administration's withholding of tens of thousands of documents related to the nominee. While many documents were released just hours before the hearing, Democrats protested the last-minute nature of the move. Here's Democratic Senator Kamala Harris interrupting the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, as he made his opening remarks.
The committee received just last night, less than 15 hours ago, 42,000 pages of documents that we have not had an opportunity to review or read or analyze.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
We cannot possibly move forward, Mr. Chairman.
I extend a very warm welcome to Judge Kavanaugh.
We have not been given an opportunity to have a meaningful hearing on the nominee.
If you thought that was the peak of today's drama, not quite. Kimmy King joins us now to talk more about today's proceedings. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back. And that was only day one. Can
yeah.
you imagine what it's going to be like on day 20?
Senate confirmation hearings you don't usually think of as high drama. This one was pretty lively. Can you talk some more about what we saw throughout the day?
So it was rather lively in terms of the spirit of the protesters, and there is much of the backstory on this Senate confirmation that is not a function of Judge Kavanaugh or his record, but a function of the prior nomination, which was Neil Gorsuch. And as your viewers will undoubtedly recall, that one was held up after Justice Scalia's untimely death. The Obama administration had wanted to put in Merrick Garland, who ironically is the current chief judge on the D.C. circuit. He is Kavanaugh's boss in some ways, but Garland was stopped. And so I think that's what you can attribute much of the acrimony over as it relates to today.
I want to play a bit more from this morning's events. Here's Utah Senator Orrin Hatch.
What's remarkable about Judge Kavanaugh's judicial record is not just its length, but its depth and its quality. Judge Kavanaugh has been a true thought leader. He's written powerful opinions on the separation of powers and administrative law.
So multiple protesters shouting during the event and then removed, some arrested. Kimmy, can you talk about that a little?
So it is the case that in high-profile congressional hearings, not just in the Senate but also in the House, you will have folks who come in because they want to make a statement. And people have some confusion thinking that there is a First Amendment right to be heard, but it depends upon the context in which that occurs. And so there is no free speech right guaranteed there in the chamber. And so it is often the case that you see people making, in essence, what are symbolic protests to disrupt the proceedings. And that's what you hear going out throughout the day. And it wasn't just that one, although that was certainly one of the more vocal ones. It went on throughout the hearing process until it was much later in the day.
Now, Democrats in their opening statements and their procedural efforts didn't really so much talk about Brett Kavanaugh as the process. They said it's rushed. They say a lot of information about a lot of documents related to Kavanaugh they're not getting. They're getting late. They're not able to release a lot into the public. Can you talk about that tactic?
So, understandably, there is this concern about what might be in other documents that Kavanaugh was involved in when, as it relates to the impeachment of Bill Clinton or during service, you know, to the Bush administration. And that's what the clamoring is about. Part of the reason why there are so many documents is because he has had 307 written opinions, which is and more than 10,000 pages of his writing. And in addition, 17,000 pages of speeches and articles and other documents. And so you always walk a fine line between all of the materials being out there and then all of the materials being out there. For Judge Bork, who some may remember was nominated in the 1980s, it was in all of the documents that were submitted that ultimately Bork wound up being, as we proverbially like to call it, being borked, right? He got borked because of the information that he had written in documents. So that's where part of that is coming from. But also understand that not all of the documents have to be provided when someone is serving as presidential counsel. Depending on the nature of those documents, they are not necessarily released. And so that is what the Republicans are hanging their hat on, and the Democrats are hanging it on the other side of the coat rack, saying, no, we have to be able to see everything, and there's just too much of what is here. And so that's the crux of the problem. Let's be very clear and cut through this for your listeners. This is fundamentally about people having drawn ideological lines regarding Judge Kavanaugh, and they are going to marshal every argument they can to either support him or to drop him. And that's what this is about.
Talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas about the opening day of the confirmation hearings in the Senate for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Well, let's talk about some of those ideological differences and a couple of the issues that people are watching for here. And let's start with one of the biggies, abortion access, Roe versus Wade. Is Justice Kavanaugh a fifth vote to overturn Roe versus Wade if a case makes it up to a new court with him on it?
So that's what's going to be interesting to see, because at the end of his days, Kennedy had become more of a supporter for abortion rights in some ways. And so that is why you see, you know, Republican senators that are pro-choice concerned, especially, you know, like Collins and Murkowski, two female Republican senators who believe they have his assurance that he has agreed Roe v. Wade is settled law. Still, there are others who point to a decision more recently involving an immigrant detainee who was a teenager seeking an abortion, and he had dissented in that case regarding this undocumented immigrant teen's request for an abortion because she was being held in a detention center. She was at her 15th week, and ultimately, what happened with Kavanaugh, without taking you into all the basics, is that he wound up being overruled by the full D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and they basically dismissed the ruling or the decision, the thinking of Kavanaugh regarding that undocumented immigrant, and she was dispatched to an abortion facility via the D.C. Circuit's final decision. So that's where everyone is saying, well, does he see Roe as settled law, or will he look for ways in which it could be limited, and they will point to the undocumented immigrant case?
And abortion rights supporters say, well, it's law that was settled by a previous Supreme Court. What the Supreme Court settles, it can resettle later, right?
That's absolutely the case. Remember that in his 2006 hearings, you know, stay tuned for what's going to happen, but you're going to hear Republican senators make much of the fact that in his 2006 hearings, when he was being put forward to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, he had indicated that it was settled law, and circuit courts of appeals are required to follow settled law. But as a Supreme Court justice, you have greater latitude because you have to look very closely at the policy distinctions. And so that's why some people say that the Supreme Court makes the laws because of the way in which they decide the laws. And that's why Democrats are so scared.
Another issue that's been coming up is an issue related to separation of powers. Hypothetical questions like, say, there was a probe related to a sitting president, and related issues to that came before the Supreme Court. Issues of, can you charge a president with a crime? What are people looking at with Brett Kavanaugh on that kind of issue?
So it's interesting that in some ways Kavanaugh is unique because, remember, he worked on the case to impeach Clinton. And so Kavanaugh is going to have a little bit of dissonance, I would think, inside himself if you're hypothetical, as it might possibly become not so hypothetical in the near future, you know, actually comes about, because he was supportive of the impeachment of Clinton. However, in working on the case, however, he did indicate that there might be grounds for a delay of game relating to the impeachment of a president. And that's why everyone wants to figure out what his views on presidential power would be. You heard statements from the senators today who were making their speeches, even though they were calling them opening comments, they really were speeches. They are concerned that he has a broader view of executive power and that he has been chosen by Trump for just this reason. I would point out to folks, however, that everyone said the same thing about Chief Justice Roberts, who clearly had a more expansive view of presidential power before he was nominated, and that did not stop him from being confirmed as Chief Justice of the court.
We're talking to Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, looking at the political fight over the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping to hear from the nominee in these confirmation hearings? What do you want senators of either party to ask of the nominee? Do you think the process is moving too quickly, or does it need to be resolved soon? What are you worried about? What are you hopeful for? And if you are a Democrat in particular, are you hoping that Democratic senators put up a big fight to set up a lot of roadblocks here? If you're a Republican, do you think this should be smooth sailing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We continue our conversation with Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, looking at the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh. They started today. We're looking at what's happened so far and what's expected in the days to come. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does Kavanaugh deserve a seat on the nation's highest court? What do you hope comes out of this vetting process in the Senate confirmation? Do you think that this is mostly just a political show, partisan debate, or can we get something useful out of this process? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Before we go to our callers, Kimmy, I want to give a listen to Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson talking to ABC News about the document issue and about the confirmation.
I mean, the Democrats have more than enough information to understand that this is a highly qualified jurist that should be the next Supreme Court justice. In an earlier time, 30 years ago, he would have passed unanimously.
Kimmy, do you agree? 3 decades ago, would this be less of a contentious process, a sure thing for a judge like Kavanaugh?
I think it would be much less. I don't know that would be a sure thing. Recall that the mid-1980s were rough on Republican nominees, and certainly Judge Bork would not agree that it was an easy haul, or you know, some of the Bush nominees that were failed before he finally was able to go on and get some of his nominees on. But it is clear that since the 1990s, the level of Supreme Court nominations and the anger expressed in that nomination process on the side of both parties has been much more rancorous. I think I would also point out that this issue of appointing people to the bench is at the cornerstone of our judicial system. It's why we have Article III. And in fact, if you go back to Marbury versus Madison in 1803, which basically allows for the principle of judicial review, for the courts to review the actions of Congress and the executive branch, that was about court packing. So we have always been fighting about nominating judges to the bench. It's just how mean and bloody we get when we fight that is different, and there's no doubt this one is going to be a bloodbath.
Let's go to our callers now. Ian is with us in Milwaukee. Ian, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious what are Brett Kavanaugh's positions on things like Citizens United and campaign finance law, if he were ever to have to pass a decision on those topics.
Ian, thanks for the call. Have we seen anything in Brett Kavanaugh's background on those campaign finance issues, Kimmy?
So there is concern. That's a great question, by the way. There has been some concern that he supports corporate interests. And in one of the decisions that deals with the ability to regulate, when he was on the Court of Appeals, Kavanaugh dissented in what the SeaWorld case, that's the whale case. And in that case, he criticized the Labor Department for having penalized SeaWorld with their regulations after a trainer died. And he argued, in essence, that they should not have been regulating that. Now, he lost. He was the dissent in that case. By the way, Merrick Garland was the chief judge in that case. So he was in the 2-1 majority that decided and said that the Labor Department could regulate. But in some ways, that has been seen as a corporate interest case. And so that there might be some inference there that I know about. The other case that you might possibly be thinking of is a case that has to do with net neutrality and the FCC regulating. And he has been against allowing the FCC to be able to regulate in those instances. And so, again, people will point to that and say, see, he supports corporate and broadband business owners against the little guy. And so that, by inference, if would help with answering your caller's question. I'm going to write that down and go look that up. I will send you an answer to that if I know anything specific on campaign finance. That has not been on my radar.
Ian, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Pam in Oconto. Pam, hi. Pam?
Yeah.
Hi, go ahead.
Basically what I'm saying is that I think that the Republicans basically set a precedent with the last Supreme Court justice that was sworn in when they said we should wait till the election and let the new president decide who was going to be looked at. I think it should be the same way. We got the midterm elections coming up. Why can't we wait until the midterm elections and then get the new people in and then go from there and vote?
Pam, thanks for the call. So, yeah, with the Merrick Garland nomination, Republicans said, hey, let's let voters put in a new president. Democrats are saying, okay, let's let voters decide on a new Senate before we go ahead here.
Yes, and that's where much of the anger comes from the Democrats. The only thing I would caution about that is to recognize that through the election process, you are leaving someone out and away from the court with only 8 justices to resolve the 10,000 cases that they get. And so it becomes this argument of justice delayed is justice denied. The argument is or could be that the Republicans should not have delayed it, nor should the Democrats have. So just because someone shoots you in the foot, do you turn around and shoot them in the foot? but that's the way it's going to be. And understand that your, you know, Wisconsin is divided on this. You know, you gave the quote from Ron Johnson. It's my understanding that Tammy Baldwin has come out against the Supreme Court nominee. So, you know, the country is polarized, and these nominations are going to be polarized as a result. And I think that's the frustration that your caller is legitimately expressing.
Pam, thanks for that call. We're talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas about today's nomination hearings in the U.S. Senate for nominee Brett Kavanaugh. One image that's gotten a lot of attention already, Kimmy, during a break, Fred Gutenberg, father of one of the children killed in the Parkland school shooting, came up, introduced himself, tried to shake Judge Kavanaugh's hand. He turned away. We've heard a different take on that already from Rod Schoff with the White House. But this, the picture is going all over the place. Kind of an iconic moment already, if you can say that this soon.
Well, you're going to see a few more of those. I mean, I think most people looking at Kavanaugh, who seems to be a pretty easygoing, you know, serious person, but smiles a great deal, usually looked very serious and quite glum throughout the opening of the proceedings. And while I haven't seen the picture, I do know there has been much furor over a dissent that Kavanaugh gave from a majority opinion in the D.C. Circuit. That majority opinion upheld the ban on semi-automatic rifles. And Kavanaugh dissented, arguing that most guns today are semi-automatic, and so they are constitutionally protected. There was much outcry over that with Kavanaugh then, and so I'm sure he's been advised to sort of be very cautious about his public image. But you're going to continue to see those kinds of image moments be made throughout the hearings, both vocally and also visually, as people try to make statements that, again, are not about Kavanaugh, but are fundamentally about this process.
I want to give a listen to one more bit from today, Republican Senator John Cornyn.
And I sincerely hope this week we can all take a deep breath. We're not doing very well so far. And get a grip and treat this process with the respect and gravity it demands.
So can that happen, Kimmy?
I don't know. That's a, now you're in my backyard with Senator Cornyn here. I think what he's trying to do is to allow the proceedings to move forward. Certainly if they're going to be interrupted every 10 seconds, it's going to create problems, and it does not reflect well on the legitimacy of the process if the views, both opposing and supporting, are not heard. Here's the real risk that can be run in this process. You saw with Justice Thomas, because he was badly bloodied in his confirmation process regarding the Anita Hill scandal, he certainly had a reaction to that and came away very bitter as a result of it. It's too soon to tell whether that was the case with Gorsuch. He certainly hasn't appeared to be that way. But there can be a brutalizing of a nominee so that it forces them into a position. And that's the difficult situation that I think Democrats and Republicans are going to find themselves in as they go forward with this, that they are both going to have to live with how tough they are or how critical they are of the candidates put forward, because it's going to play itself out in future nomination battles, I can guarantee you.
Kimmy, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
You betcha. It's always fun. Support your public radio, people.
Kimmy King is a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. We've been talking about the political fight over the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh.